The guys who survived the prison in Taganrog told stories that would make your skin crawl. I honestly don't know how anyone survived that or how their minds didn't completely snap. They loved their job so fanatically that they couldn't allow a lack of equipment to stop them.
Welcome. You're watching the True War Crime Podcast, where we share the first-hand stories of people who survived Russian captivity. Today, my guest is Yevhen Malik, a close friend of mine. We've traveled to several European countries together, holding joint advocacy meetings to show people abroad how Russian disinformation impacts lives, both in civilian settings and behind bars. We used Evgen's own experiences to show them exactly how it happens and what the real-world consequences of Russia's propaganda machine look like. Hey man, great to have you in the studio. You spend a lot of time talking to foreigners. I keep tabs on the guys we did those advocacy trips with, Julian Pelepe, Vlad Zadorin, and so many others. They're all finding their paths, growing, giving talks at top-tier global research and media hubs everywhere from Yale to Cambridge. I honestly get this feeling that you guys are running on pure adrenaline, trying to make up for lost time. Like, you were artificially put on pause while in captivity, and now you're just sprinting forward at breakneck speed. Is that an accurate read on it?
Yeah, it's completely true. I mean, when you're in captivity, you don't have any other options but to think. You're forbidden from doing absolutely anything, even moving. You just stand there and think. First, you dissect the past, what you did wrong, how you ended up there, what you could have done differently during the fighting. You completely reevaluate your whole life path. Just imagine, I was a prisoner for 2.5 years, and the entire time I was just standing there trapped in those thoughts. My friend actually got released from captivity just today. He was stuck there for almost 2 years longer than me. He spent 4 years locked in that headspace. So yeah, you have plenty of time to think. You constantly obsess over what went wrong back then, how you could have handled it differently, and how it's going to affect your future. So by the time you're finally out, you know exactly, maybe not the final destination yet, but you damn sure know the pace and direction you need to move in. You grab onto the opportunities you actually need, the ones you want to bring to life. And when you commit to something, you work with everything you've got because you have this massive internal drive. Before captivity, I didn't have that at all.
Did you really change that much after captivity in that regard?
When I work now, I do it with way more quality and energy. And that's not just about work or career. It's the same with my personal life or hobbies. I put so much more of myself into my own growth now.
If I'm not mistaken, one of the last countries you visited was the United States. Can you tell us in a few words what you were doing out there?
Actually, the most recent country I visited was the UK. I was in London, but I fly to the US regularly. I alternate my trips once to Europe, once to the States, once to Europe, once to the States. When you look at it, the US is this massive country made up of dozens of states, and the European Union is also a kind of union of states, just in a different format. The United States is a federation, while the EU is more of a confederation. There are unitary, federal, and confederative forms of government. A confederative bond is the weakest in terms of centralized power, while a unitary one is the strongest. Ukraine is a unitary state. The US is a federation and the EU is a confederation, but it's still a powerful bloc. I've traveled there so many times now. Soon I'm heading to Tallinn, Estonia, and in July I'm off to the States again for at least a month. My international trips are booked solid all the way through next April. I've got another journey planned for the winter too.
I take it the goals for these visits vary, or do they mostly revolve around your core experience in captivity?
Let's put it this way. I have a primary job that allows me to go on regular overseas business trips. I combine my professional duties, doing promotion for my university since I currently work at the Kyiv School of Economics, with advocating for Ukraine's interests abroad. I constantly bring up the issue of prisoners of war and the war in general. It's my mission, considering that right now, far from every man in Ukraine has the right to just pick up and go abroad. Since I have this opportunity, I have to use it to the absolute fullest, because my background gives me access to meetings with a wide array of highly influential people. For instance, I've been to the US 3 or 4 times now. And during 2 of those trips, I visited Congress. Not even every American citizen has had the chance to step foot inside there. When I walk in, I'm not just having a beer at a bar with some random guy. I'm talking to people directly connected to the executive and legislative branches of the United States government. So I'm obligated to use that chance to remind them we have a full-scale war going on and we need to do something about it together.
Leave a like, write your comments, and subscribe to the channel. By doing so, you help us grow. That's exactly what I wanted to ask. You're talking to congressmen and other high-ranking officials sharing your story. Do you feel like they're actually capable of grasping what Russia truly is and understanding the path you had to walk?
No, that's a very complicated question. You have to look at the scale. The EU has around 450 million people, not counting the UK. The US has another 350 million. Toss in Norway and the rest of the West, and you're looking at a billion people. You can only imagine how many different opinions are out there and how people form their conclusions. Obviously, I don't talk to everyone. From what I've seen, you can divide foreigners into a few categories. The first group consists of people who genuinely root for us. And it's not because they had this deep love for Ukraine before or knew a ton about our existence. It's simply because we are objectively in the right side here. We were attacked. It's unprovoked, naked aggression, reminiscent of the start of World War II, something that has absolutely no place in the civilized world. They understand that, they empathize, and they want to help us. The second group includes those who treat us with zero respect. You have to look at Donald Trump's position, which seems very bizarre to us. There's an entire political wing backing him, guys like J.D. Vance, and these views reach all the way into Congress. The things they say prove they don't respect us. They only respect brute force. Right now, I'm deeply studying the U.S. defense doctrine and how they build their military budgets, and I have a clear picture of what exactly they don't like about Ukraine. If you want, we can talk about that separately. These politicians are de facto playing into Russia's hands. They don't want Ukraine to win this war, plain and simple. And the third category is the everyday Americans living their ordinary lives. You show up, remind them about the war, open their eyes to certain things. They're shocked for a moment, but they wake up the next day and completely forget about it because they have their own daily struggles, like worrying about their utility bills. And utilities over there are insanely expensive. Some people in Ukraine think our tariffs are high, but no, it's actually expensive over there. When you visit Washington, D.C., you can easily shell out $15 for a basic bottle of water while waiting for a meeting. That's roughly 650 hryvnias for a glass of water. You sit there thinking, how do you guys even live here? That's when you realize a $5,000 monthly salary in DC is actually pretty meager money.
I was actually talking about even more basic jarring things. For example, when you tell someone face to face about the Priyomka, the brutal intake torture. Are they even capable of processing what that means?
That stuff too. Personally, it's hard for me to grasp that the war has been raging for years now. We were captured back in 2022. There were plenty of guys who got released earlier and shared their stories with the entire world, like Alexei Anulya. So I show up to meet these foreigners who welcome me, who know exactly who I am. They listen to these facts and it completely shocks them, like they're hearing it for the very first time. They actually ask, is that really true? And this is years into a full-scale invasion, when you can literally just open Google, type in POW camps inside the Russian Federation and read all about what's happening there. What shocks me isn't so much how my stories affect them, is the fact that while they claim to support us, they remain completely oblivious. There's this massive information vacuum around the reality of this war.
It all comes down to the fact that every single person and every country lives inside their own information bubble. Popping those bubbles is exactly why we created this podcast. We produce it in English and translate it into other languages to break into their bubbles using their own native language, to show them, explain to them, and spell out things that are completely obvious to us as Ukrainians. We often live in our own illusion, assuming the entire world already knows what we know, but no, the rest of the world doesn't know.
That is the absolute truth. The work you guys are doing is incredibly vital and deeply commendable.
But look, either way, the core concept of our podcast is centered on the concrete stories of specific individuals. Today, you are our guest, so let's focus entirely on your experience, how you were captured, what was waiting for you on the other side, and go through those events in detail. You're a career military man, right? Meaning, prior to 2022, you had already served in the JFO, the Joint Forces Operation.
Yes, that's correct.
So, when you were deployed in Mariupol back in 2022, were you at all psychologically prepared for the possibility of being captured and for the fact that you'd face the exact horrors you ultimately ran into?
Man, that is a wild story. Let me tell you right off the bat. Since getting out of captivity, I absolutely despise making plans. Long-term strategic planning, I don't touch it anymore. I realized it's a total waste of time. God will show you what your real plans are anyway.
There's even a saying, if you want to make God laugh, tell him about your plans.
Exactly. That's that exact situation. I'll put it this way. Even when we were completely surrounded and knew for a fact that there was no way out on our own, I wasn't even thinking about captivity. Honestly, even a week before we had to surrender, none of us were even processing that option. I was 100% convinced that a random shell would just take me out because the shelling there was completely chaotic and random. The weapons they were using against us were so heavy that there wasn't a single undamaged building left in the city. My calculation was simple. At some point, my luck would run out and a shell would find me. Mentally, I was ready for that. The only thing I genuinely didn't want was to take a direct hit from a heavy caliber, survive, and just lie there helplessly under the rubble. I knew my guys wouldn't leave me behind, but I was terrified of that specific scenario. That's what I was actually thinking about. But captivity, I don't think anyone was thinking about that.
One of the guys I interviewed on the podcast, I think it was Oleksandr Avramenko, mentioned that during the initial interrogations, the Russians were constantly complaining. They were like, no matter which Ukrainian soldier we capture, he's either a cook, a logistics guy, or support staff. The Russians couldn't wrap their heads around how they managed to lose so many of their own battalions and still couldn't take the city for such a long time. In your opinion, based on your experience, why couldn't the Russians capture Mariupol quickly?
Why couldn't they take it quickly? Because it was a physically monumental task. We were in a critical situation. We were severely short-staffed and a solid, continuous defensive line didn't even exist. It was incredibly spread out and enemy sabotage units were constantly slipping through those massive gaps. Every single time you enter a building with your squad, you have to secure it. To do that, you have to do a complete sweep. Every single entrance into a standard 9-story building is a massive gamble, just like in Special Forces movies. You have no idea what's behind the next door. You could walk into a room, go face to face with an enemy soldier, and if he happens to be even a fraction of a second faster than you, game over, it's lights out. You can't let your guard down for a single second. So every single building had to be meticulously cleared. I remember when we were securing certain areas at the steel plant, you'd approach a structure and you couldn't even find the entrance. It was completely buried under rubble. And that was just for a standard check, meaning it wasn't even an active assault. We knew there wasn't supposed to be anyone inside, but even that was incredibly difficult, both mentally and technically. Now imagine a different scenario. You're facing a 9-story building and you know for a fact that at least 2 enemy machine gun crews with PKMs, a sniper, and a ton of infantry with AKs and grenades are dug in there, and you have to push up into that building while everything is raining down on your head. And that's assuming you even managed to sprint to the building in the first place. And that's just one building. There are thousands of them in a city with a pre-war population of around 450,000 people, plus 2 massive strategic industrial plants. Imagine trying to storm the sintering plant. It's a facility spanning 3 kilometers wide, packed with massive industrial hangars and high-rise structures. You have no idea what's inside, but you're told you have to go in and assault it. They open fire on you, and you can't even tell where the shots are coming from or how to advance. It's an insanely brutal tactical challenge. So, of course, the Russians would push in, take heavy casualties, sometimes act completely brainless, sometimes work professionally. Some things worked for them, some didn't. But our guys, the Marines, Azov, the National Guard, and all the other units, they weren't just sitting around either. They put up a ferocious fight. Storming a city is literally the most complex type of warfare there is, matched only by combat in the mountains.
Now, that probably explains why they relied so heavily on airstrikes. It was way easier for them to completely level a 9-story building where a sniper might be hiding than to send in infantry to storm it.
Exactly. Right now, I'm actually writing a research paper on the defense of Mariupol, analyzing this entire experience. I've gathered a lot of data. Well, to be precise, other people collected it while I was stuck in captivity, and I used that data to systematically map everything out. And yes, it's safe to say that the Russian military used Su-24 and Su-34 bombers to blast the city, treating them basically like field artillery, because their standard artillery just wasn't enough. No matter how much they bombarded the city with Grad multiple rocket launchers or Gvozdika self-propelled howitzers, it proved to be incredibly ineffective. Once they started using 152mm shells, specifically from M-STAR artillery systems, it yielded some results, but it still wasn't enough to completely level fortified heavy buildings. So they brought in the Air Force. From what I know, 3 military air bases were operating against Mariupol, in Crimea, Novorossiysk, and Taganrog. Usually, at least a squadron, if not an entire aviation regiment, operates from each base. To give you a sense of scale, by US standards, an air wing is about 72 aircraft split into three squadrons. So we're talking about the equivalent of an entire aviation division working around the clock. To say that's a lot is an understatement. It's a staggering scale. When you have 10 planes operating against you and each one does a single sortie a day delivering 10 bomb strikes, that's one thing. But when there are 100 planes and you're getting bombed every 30 minutes, the situation becomes critical. Yeah, I used to joke with my friends. Before the war, I watched tons of military movies. Though, after what I went through, I can't watch them anymore. I hate them now because they feel like a horrific distortion of reality. So I told them that I couldn't recall a single movie where the main characters were targeted ruthlessly and systematically. I remember the famous movie Black Hawk Down, where the US Rangers went into a city in Somalia, got surrounded, and held their ground. There was a scene where a truck mounted with an SPG-9 recoilless gun drove up and opened fire on them. And in the movie, it was portrayed as this absolute terrifying catastrophe where everyone is screaming, "Save us! What do we do?" And now I look back and think, that was just an SPG-9. Like, seriously, it's just nothing.
Sapojak launcher, man, that's just a drop in a bucket compared to heavy air bombs.
Exactly. When a half-ton air bomb is dropping on your head, a round from that miserable grenade launcher felt like absolutely nothing at the time. Seriously.
One of my previous guests shared a similar story from Mariupol. A guy stepped out of the shelter to have a smoke, and an air bomb detonated nearby. He wasn't even hit by shrapnel, but the blast wave was so incredibly powerful that it completely tore his body apart, and he died on the spot. But when it finally sank in, that captivity was inevitable. What was your emotional state like? Did you have any idea that you'd face the exact things that happened next?
First off, based on the experience of all the defenders who held the line at Azovstal or the Ilyich steel plant, the exact moment you have to make that decision, you suddenly get this acute realization of why you need to survive. You instantly find reasons why you must preserve your life at all costs. When an intense battle is raging, and the combat in Mariupol lasted for a month and a half for some, 2 months for others, you're never sitting still. You're constantly moving, maneuvering. You aren't thinking about survival in some abstract way. You're just executing. But once you've held out and you're faced with the final choice, you only have two options left, either shoot yourself or surrender. We all understood perfectly well that Russian captivity wasn't going to be like being a prisoner in France. The manners of the French and the Russians differ quite a bit, obviously. You realize this, but your internal survival instincts still force you to push on. I even used to joke that it felt like some kind of symbiote had taken up residence inside me. Personally, I was so utterly exhausted that I had zero strength left to run anywhere, do anything, or care about surviving. Yet my legs kept moving and my mouth kept talking. There was this distinct feeling that someone else inside me desperately wanted to live and took full control. When you're physically depleted, everything hurts and you see absolutely no point. You just keep going on pure autopilot. I don't even know how to properly explain it. And when it came time to make the choice to surrender, that inner voice gave me clear arguments for why I had to do it. My thoughts back then were, all right, so they'll break all my bones, but in a month I'll be home. I absolutely had to make it back because my mom, my dad, and my brother were waiting for me. Plus, I hadn't even had a chance to start my own family yet. And I really wanted to do that, meaning I had to live. Sure, they'll beat me, they'll break some bones. Yeah, it's gonna hurt like hell, but I have to get through it. You can't just give up and die. Back then, I was absolutely convinced that the Russians would brutally retaliate and mangle us, but within a month at most, we'd be back home through a prisoner exchange. And once again, a god heard my thoughts, laughed, and disposed of my fate in a completely different way.
I'm sorry, but why were you so sure you'd be home in a month? Did it really seem like the war would end that quickly?
I had a clear understanding of what was happening on the other fronts. While we were tying down the enemy's southern grouping of forces, the invading troops pushing from the north had already been severely routed by our military. Around mid-March, right before we completely lost comms, we were still seeing photos and updates from our forces. My dad and brother were also fighting. I knew my brother was participating in the clearing of Irpin, and my dad was executing missions near Moshchun, so I knew the situation in the north was under control, even though an immense number of enemy troops had flooded that area. I'll say even more. When I went out to negotiate with the Russian side, I had a very specific plan. We had just under 100 guys left at that point, 96 to be exact. I walked into the negotiations and told them, "Look, I have comms. I can call our command. You transport us to the Zaporizhia region at the line of contact, and in return, they will immediately bring your prisoners straight from Kyiv. We'll do a one-for-one or a one-for-two swap." After I returned from captivity, when I was debriefing with our agencies, they confirmed that they were ready to give up even more personnel for us, and we had the necessary swap pool ready. But back then, the Russians gave a flat answer. No one leaves Mariupol alive. At the time, I couldn't fully comprehend the reason behind such an uncompromising stance. It was only later, once I was in captivity and the initial interrogations and torture began, that it all made sense.
Were they just incredibly resentful because of Mariupol's prolonged resistance, or was it something else?
No, it's way deeper and far more horrific than that. Think about it. How many civilians were slaughtered in Mariupol because the Russians were blindly carpet bombing everything? We're talking about tens of thousands of people. They still can't fully calculate the exact death toll to this day. It's a staggering number of dead, mangled, and missing people. Who did that? Obviously the Russians. And the Russians themselves know it perfectly well. But they can't just openly admit to the world that they slaughtered tens of thousands of innocent civilians. Look at Bucha. Hundreds of people were executed there, and it outraged the entire globe. In Mariupol, it was tens of thousands. It is pure genocide. To this day, in modern history, there isn't another example of such a massive simultaneous slaughter of a civilian population within a single city. It's a monumental war crime. How can they justify that to the international community? They can't. There is absolutely no justification. So they urgently needed to shift the blame. They had to create a narrative showing that someone else did it. And suddenly they found themselves holding about 4,500 prisoners of war from the Mariupol garrison. So they decided, all right, our most humane and honest court in the world will now figure out who's to blame for everything. And that's exactly how every single interrogation in captivity started. They would systematically break you physically and psychologically, forcing you to sign a confession stating that you shot 30 civilians or that you raped someone or looted a home. That was the entire substance of their investigation. We'll get back to the torture in a bit.
They were forcing guys to confess to just walking around with a rifle and destroying any
exactly.
civilian building.
But the script
saw.
Was always the same. They wanted you to say you were high on some substances, that you were having fun, that you craved blood and were deliberately killing innocent residents of Mariupol instead of Russian soldiers.
And they tried to force that exact framework onto all 4,500
Precisely.
Prisoners.
That was their master plan. They couldn't just hand us over in an exchange because they needed to manufacture war criminals out of us to dump their own guilt onto our shoulders. That's exactly why the question of why the fighters from Azov, the National Guard, and the Marines from Mariupol are being held for so long remains open. Guys have been stuck in captivity for years now. They are still trying to pin all these atrocities on them because Russia is solely responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of civilians in Mariupol. They are doing everything in their power to cover it up.
All right, let's go back directly to your story. You enter captivity. What happened during the first 3 days? How did the Russians react and what did they say or ask?
First, we were taken to Olen Ivka, just like most of the Mariupol defenders. It was a kind of filtration transit camp. What's important to note, there were no actual Russian military personnel there at first. Olen Ivka was guarded by the so-called DNR guys, local collaborators. They had an intake procedure there too, but compared to what came later inside the Russian Federation, you could barely even call it a harsh prayomka. It was more like a rough welcoming. They beat some guys with rubber truncheons or belts. I personally took about 4 hits to the back with a truncheon, and they whacked my knees a bit. Sure, it left bruises, but compared to the sheer horror that followed in Russia, that was...
child's play?
Pretty much, yeah. They processed us quickly and confiscated our shoelaces. Before that, there was a brief stop in Sartana, but we arrived there at noon, and by evening we were already being transferred further. The absolute worst thing I remember about Olenivka was the complete and total lack of water. There wasn't a single drop for 4 straight days. We tried to manage and survive somehow. Whenever they gathered us into work details, we'd scour the grounds for old filthy plastic jugs, you know, standard 5-liter water bottles. They'd been lying around there for God knows how long, to the point where a whole green ecosystem had formed inside them, but we gathered any container we could find. If our detail was let out near some water source or just a basic tap on the property, we'd fill them up and smuggle the water back to the barracks to drink. For the entire barracks, which crammed in over 830 people, we had a grand total of 2 or 3 cups. Just picture it. 2 cups of water for 830 men. We stood in lines, in columns. The only thing that saved us was that we were military men and maintained strict discipline. But that level of extreme thirst is one of the most brutal trials you can face. When there's no water, people psychologically start hitting their breaking point. And that's a completely natural biological reaction. It's not a sign of weakness. Your body is literally screaming, dude, do something, or we're going to die right here. That same internal autopilot, the symbiote I mentioned, takes over. and you have 830 guys in that exact state simultaneously. Thank God we had officers who were able to take control of the situation and maintain order. You mentioned Julian from the Marines earlier. In that specific moment, he stepped up like a true commander. There was a whole group of leaders like that, and thanks to them, we survived that critical phase. As for the food, it was microscopic. In the morning, they gave us a quarter of a loaf of bread and some tea. At lunch, the same quarter loaf with a bit of sauerkraut or some plain barley every other day, plus tea. For dinner, just another piece of bread and tea. That was literally it.
Well, at least it was something, because I know of cases where prisoners were given absolutely zero food.
From what I gather, that mostly happened to the guys captured in the north of Ukraine who were immediately transferred through Belarus into Russia. They could go entirely without food for 3 or 4 days straight. But for those who were routed to the Donbas, to Olenivka, or other camps in the occupied territory, they at least provided a bare minimum.
Right. Oleksandr Avramenko mentioned the same thing when we recorded his episode. By the way, there's a link on the screen right now. You can click it and watch his episode as soon as you finish this one. He was also trying to escape from Mariupol. I can't recall the exact name of the settlement where they caught him, but he was held there for 27 days. During that entire time, they didn't give him a single bite of food. Only some kind of industrial, non-potable water to drink. So for 27 days, the man survived purely on water. He only got his first real meal after going through a brutal pryomka and being transferred to a different facility. So how many transfers or transit stages did you go through in total?
Olenivka, Ryazsk, and Mordovia. I don't even count Sartana as a real stage.
Got it. So you ultimately settled in Mordovia and spent most of your time there? I take it Mordovia was where the conditions were the absolute worst?
Mordovia was actually far from the worst place among all the Russian prisons. I mean, it's hard for me to even imagine anything worse than what I witnessed there, but objectively speaking, worse places definitely existed. If you rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, based on what the other guys told me later, Mordovia was around a 7. I don't even know how to describe it, because after everything I went through in Mordovia, it's hard to imagine what else you'd have to invent to make the torture worse. But I know for a fact what was happening in Taganrog. It is a genuine miracle and an act of God that I was spared from that place, because originally they were trafficking us straight there and we didn't even know it. There's actually a paradoxical and almost dark funny story tied to that. When we were still back in Olenivka filling out the paperwork for our transfer to Russia, we sincerely believed we were heading to a prisoner exchange. One of the local guards told us, hurry up and sign the papers to go to Russia. Here, under the DNR, all the locals are furious with you. But out there, deep in the Russian heartland, people don't care. They have no idea what's going on here and they don't give a damn about Ukrainians. Looking back, that sounds like the most twisted joke ever, because the DNR guys turned out to be completely tolerable compared to the Russians, and I heard the LNR guards were even calmer. But once we crossed into Russia proper, we collided with absolute unadulterated sadism, though I've heard different stories. I left Olenivka after just 4 days, but the guys who were stuck there long term told me during later transit stages that after we left, the regime in Olenivka changed completely. It became just as unbearable and brutal as Mordovia.
Yeah, I noticed that too when talking to former prisoners. Someone will say that in the exact same prison, the conditions were fine at first, then became horrific, or vice versa. Everyone's destiny played out so differently. I guess it all came down to the specific shift of guards, the specific special forces unit on duty, or new orders from the top. Every period was completely unpredictable. But there is a clear pattern. On the occupied territories of Donetsk and Luhansk, the initial stages were a bit easier than inside the Russian Federation. If you look at it globally,
I'd say the rule of thumb was the further east into Russia you went, the worse it got. The stories coming out from the guys who ended up in the Altai region, past the Urals or in Volgograd, it makes your blood run cold just thinking about it.
Mikola Yevarlak shared details about an extraordinarily brutal prison in Vyazma on our podcast. That was one of our previous episodes. The conditions there were subhuman. For instance, in the dead of winter during sub-zero temperatures, the guards forced the prisoners to keep the cell windows wide open.
Oh yeah, that's their classic textbook move. But from everything I know, Taganrog is a special kind of hell that needs to be remembered. They were systematically destroying people's bodies there. They were breaking them and torturing them in the most literal sense of the word.
All right, Mordovia, you arrived there. I take it there was a brutal intake process. What kind of cell did they put you in?
Mordovia is actually the final chapter of the story, because before that came the nightmare of Ryazsk.
And how long did you spend in Ryazsk?
10 months.
Wow, so that was a massive chunk of time. All right, let's talk about Ryazsk. What was it like? What were the conditions? And what kind of cell were you locked in?
Well, again, we rode toward Ryazsk with absolute certainty that we were heading to an exchange. They brought us in on buses, and then these security forces in all black uniforms stormed in. I assume it was OMON or some other special forces unit. They ordered us to keep our heads down, taped our hands tightly with packing tape, and started throwing us onto a plane. Right then and there, they started getting incredibly rough, and it clicked. This is definitely not an exchange, but nobody knew where they were taking us. Our eyes were taped shut tightly. We flew for God knows how long, and after we landed, they threw us into a prison transport truck. They crammed me into what's called a stakan, the glass, which is an extraordinarily tight, single-occupancy isolation box. I sat there with my eyes taped, my hands bound, and at one point it just hit me. Man, this is it. It's over. For a month and a half, I fought the Russians. We were killing them. And now I'm deep inside the Russian Federation, bound hand and foot, and only God knows where I am. I realized they could do absolutely anything they wanted to me. This is Russia, a country where the government doesn't even spare its own citizens, where people just vanish without a trace. I thought, maybe they hauled me out to Siberia, they're gonna strip me for organs and nobody will ever find out. I had a million questions, but zero answers. While we were moving, I would just black out periodically because I completely lost all sense of space and time. With my eyes covered, I couldn't tell where I was, what time it was, or whether it was day or night. I kept losing consciousness. And for some reason, while we were in transit, as I tried to imagine what they were going to do to me, a random scene from the movie Lethal Weapon starring Mel Gibson popped into my head. There was this scene where he gets captured by thugs tied up by his hands to the ceiling in a basement, beaten and tortured with electricity. I don't know why I remembered that specific scene. I was just a teenager when I watched that movie.
And that was your internal expectation of what was coming?
I wouldn't say I consciously expected it, but that visual was just deeply seared into my mind. And as it turned out later, it was terrifyingly close to what actually happened to us there. Just imagine that.
Horrific. The psychological toll of that?
Yeah, exactly. Imagine I watched that movie maybe 20 years ago, and in that exact moment of crisis, my brain pulled up that specific frame. I just thought, all right, let's see. Finally, they dragged us into the prison at Ryazsk, and everything kicked off with them demanding we sing Soviet propaganda songs, stuff like Smaglyanka, Katyusha, or Den Pobedi, Victory Day. But I don't know them at all. I sat there thinking, are you guys kidding me? I've never sung in my life. I'm completely tone deaf. I don't know any lyrics. I'd probably heard Katyusha maybe twice in my entire life. I didn't know the words. I didn't know the melody. Then they started demanding the Russian national anthem. The Russian anthem? Are you out of your minds? I'm a soldier. I know and sing my national anthem. Why on earth would I know yours?
How did that work logistically? Did they blast an audio recording for you or what?
No, they just forced us to drop to the floor in what they called the monashka, the nun's pose. It's a stress position where you are forced to kneel, slam your forehead against the floor, hands tied behind your back, elbows pressed to the ground, and your knuckles pointing up over your head. That's the position they called the nun's pose.
And you were forced to sing while locked in that position?
Exactly. That's how you wait for your turn to go through the intake processing. When my time came, they grabbed me, dragged me out into the corridor, and forced me to strip down to my underwear. That was it. I was barefoot, completely naked except for my boxers. I had to shed all my clothes. In that state, they marched me to a medical officer. Her job, as I understood it, was to perform a quick inspection of your body. She would give the guards a specific signal, meaning whether they could proceed with using force or not. Because coming out of Olenivka, the guys were in all kinds of bad shape. Someone might have broken ribs, so they tried not to butcher them too badly during the first stage, because providing actual medical treatment later would be too much of a hassle for them.
So she was basically deciding whether they were allowed to beat you or not?
Exactly. I figured it out when I turned around. She looked at me very closely and noticed a massive bruise under my knee from where I had been hit by an army belt buckle. She locked her eyes on it, and then, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed her give a barely visible nod to the special forces guy standing right next to me. He grabbed me instantly. Moving around that place was only permitted in a deeply bent position, the horse pose, as they called it. They dragged me into a room where a table was piled high with stacks of documents. There were people sitting there in blue uniforms that looked visually almost identical to our Ukrainian naval uniforms. We all noticed that later and wondered what kind of unit it was. As it turned out, it was the Federal Penitentiary Service of Russia. At that point, we didn't even know such an organization existed and had no idea what it was. A man was sitting at the table with all our confiscated documents laid out in front of him. I had somehow miraculously managed to keep my military ID. The thing was, before the full-scale invasion, I was working at headquarters and managed to mail all my personal documents and belongings back home via Nova Pochta because I knew damn well a major war was coming. But I kept my military ID on me and they seized it during the search. The officer at the table says, "Find your documents in these piles." I found my ID and showed it to him. He started reading it out loud. Position, name, rank, I confirmed, Junior Sergeant Malik. He was verifying the data, which clearly stated squad leader, vehicle commander. The special forces guy standing next to me cut in, "What kind of vehicle?" I said, "Baita, BTR-80. The next question was obvious. "Did you shoot at our guys?" And right then, a thought flashed through my head. I'm a junior sergeant, a squad leader. How can I lie and say I didn't shoot? What had I been doing in Mariupol for a month and a half by their logic? Leading a unit, fighting in battles, of course, all kinds of things happened. At the same time, I knew I couldn't just tell him bluntly, "Yeah, I shot and killed this many of your soldiers." Anyone who's been in close quarters infantry combat knows that in urban warfare, you rarely even see the enemy's face. Everything is decided by the density of suppressive fire. But I couldn't just tell a cowardly lie either. So I decided to respond with a purely military term. I suppressed enemy operations with suppressive fire. The special forces guy went absolutely ballistic at that answer. It's hard to describe his reaction in clean words. To put it short, he cursed at me and screamed, "You're done, Malik!" He yanked me out of the office and we ran down the corridor. At a T-shaped intersection, he stopped me abruptly and spun me 90 degrees. I stood there with my head forced down and he shouted at the top of his lungs down the entire hallway, "Hey boys, this piece of trash was shooting at our guys from an IAV in Mariupol." I lifted my head for a split second just to see who he was talking to. I look, and there are about a dozen OMON guys standing in the corridor in black uniforms, combat boots, fully geared up, and all of them are staring straight at me. My stomach completely dropped. They marched me through that corridor. I could barely keep track of the blows, a hit to the head, a boot to the ribs, a strike to the knees. They were just passing me from hand to hand. One guard held my arms pinned behind my back and dragged me forward while everyone else lining the walls just mercilessly battered me wherever they pleased. Finally, they threw me into some room. There was a stool inside and an inmate with a hair clipper was sitting there. They shoved me down onto that stool and this inmate started hurriedly shaving my head. But while he was doing it, two special forces guys burst into the room and just started punching me in the head from both sides. My head was bouncing back and forth like a football. That poor inmate couldn't even aim the clipper, trying his best to finish the job. But he couldn't exactly tell these crazed guards, "Hey, wait up, let me finish trimming him." If he had squeaked a single word, he would have dropped right next to me. He twisted and turned as best as he could, but they kept lunging with their fists. At some point, one of the special forces guys got fed up, shoved the barber away and barked, "Get the hell out of here." They stood me up against the wall and started beating the life out of me. Together, I tried to shield myself, putting up blocks. They didn't like that, and one growled, "Stand straight, hands behind your back." I complied, brought my hands behind my back, and they just started working me over like a punching bag. They struck everywhere they could see, nose, ears, jaw, solar plexus, ribs, and legs. They just completely tore me apart between the two of them. Right after that, they marched me into another office, and a staff member from the FSIN was sitting at the desk wearing a balaclava, and a detailed map of our industrial plant in Mariupol was laid out right in front of him. They ordered me to sit. He started the interrogation. Call sign, unit, exact positions on the map. I answered clearly and truthfully, but parallel to this, the other guard standing behind me kept beating me. They beat me without stopping. At one point, someone gave me such a vicious blow to the head that everything just went completely blurry. My face was totally covered in blood, my consciousness was fading fast, and I couldn't even process anything anymore. The officer at the desk looked at me and said, "All right, take him away." They dragged me back out into the corridor where the rest of our guys were standing. The guard wanted to shove me toward them so we could keep sharing our experiences about who shot where. But at that exact moment, another staff member from the facility cut across the hallway. Judging by his uniform and his prominent bureaucratic belly, he was some local political officer or a higher-ranking administrator, not a rank-and-file special forces guy. He caught me by the shoulder and told the escort, "That's enough for him today. I'll take it from here." That special forces guard turned around and left, and this heavy-set man led me to the second floor. On the way up, I heard the guards shout out down the hall, "Put this one in 19. We approach the door. I'm walking completely hunched over, barely moving my feet, totally broken. By that point, they had already ripped the packing tape off my face, so I could finally see at least something. The very first thing I had witnessed in this prison was a dozen enraged men kicking the crap out of me. I was in a state of profound shock, having no idea where I was or what they even wanted from me. And then this man leading me suddenly says in a calm voice, "You know, I respect you. You know why? Because you honestly admitted that you shot at us." I'm walking, blood dripping from my mangled face onto every single step, and I'm thinking to myself, "Wow, how respectful of you. Thanks a lot. Now, what else can I even say? You're a real class act. Respect to you and your whole establishment. You guys are truly the best people in the world." In the end, they shoved me into the cell and tossed me some old ragged waffle towel. I spent the entire next week just using that towel to wipe away the blood that kept constantly pouring from my nose and wounds.
And all of that was just the initial intake process?
Yeah, that was only the beginning. Every single prisoner went through an identical experience. Absolutely everyone was put through those exact abuses. Afterwards, from what I remember, we were distributed into cells at CISO number 2 in the town of Ryazsk, Ryazan Oblast. When I was locked up there, we even knew the name of the street, but I just can't recall it now. After my release, I actually looked up this remand prison on Google Maps. They have an official website where you could even leave a review if you wanted to. I remember thinking, ironically at the time, I should write them a review telling them to teach their cooks and food servers basic arithmetic. For the entire 10 months we were held there, they couldn't figure out how to divide the food properly so everyone got an equal share. I wanted to write, "Is it really that hard to count, you absolute morons? You have a ladle that holds 300 or 400 milliliters, and you have a 40-liter military food thermos." Knowing the exact number of people in the cell, it's elementary to calculate how much needs to go into each plate. Why on earth did the portions vary so wildly every single time?
So did you end up writing them that review?
Of course I didn't. It's more of a dark, twisted joke. You know, like leaving a review on Booking after staying at an apartment.
Right, give them the star rating they deserve.
Exactly, that was the thought.
I honestly, truly admire you and the rest of the guys. You talk about these horrific beatings, but you do it with a smile and this incredible self-irony. An outsider watching this might think, wow, it's almost a party in those Russian prisons. Maybe I should go out there and get a real taste of life.
Well, you know, when I was stuck there, we had a very diverse group of people. There were mobilized guys, experienced older warriors who were already in their 40s or 50s, and compared to them, I was still just a kid. And those older men kept repeating to me, "Sooner or later, we're going to get out of here, we're going to look back at all of this, and we're going to laugh." But back then, when they were telling me that, I didn't find it funny at all. I was cursing everything in existence, but the real absolute horror didn't hit me until later when I ended up in Mordovia. Because in Ryazsk, the place I'm talking about now, the conditions at first were still somewhat tolerable. It was far from the worst of what we had to endure.
But generally, looking at your entire time in Ryazsk, what were the conditions like? Did things stabilize over time?
Let me explain how the system worked. In the beginning, a special investigative task force would arrive at every single Russian CISO. As bizarre as it sounds in the context of being a POW, we actually got pretty lucky with the investigators assigned to our rotations because they ran the interrogations. And make no mistake, interrogations were happening everywhere, whether it was Ryazsk, Volgograd, Taganrog, Vyazma, or Vladimir. Horrific things happened inside those rooms. However, these specific investigators forced the local guards and special forces to keep themselves in check. Outside of the official interrogations, they didn't allow the prison staff to inflict completely unprovoked abuses on us. And that's a fact. The personnel was split between the visiting special forces units and the local prison guards. Among the local CISO guards who wore the standard uniforms, you'd run into all kinds of people. When they marched us out for our mandatory mugshots, we'd occasionally exchange a few words. One of them told me straight up, "We don't even understand what you guys are doing here. We've spent our whole lives working with ordinary inmates, with the criminal element. We are used to a completely different demographic, but you guys are career military men who fought in a war. What is happening and why they are keeping you here, we can't even grasp ourselves." But those employees who showed even a shred of humanity and had those kinds of thoughts vanished very quickly. They were replaced by others. And the new ones, they understood exactly why they were there and they came with a very specific purpose. Of course, different things happened in different cells. The guards were formally forbidden from torturing us purely for entertainment, even though many of them desperately craved it. There were times, and I, along with many other guys, ran into this, where the investigators would literally put the local prison leadership in their place, demanding that the prisoners not be touched without their knowledge. But when you stepped into an interrogation room with those exact investigators, man, in those moments you'd find yourself wishing you were just getting beaten in the corridor every single day, like they routinely did to us later in Mordovia, rather than enduring what they cooked up in those offices. From what I know about other prisons, the combination was often catastrophic. When the investigators arrived, they would torture people during interrogations, but parallel to that, the local guards would still pull prisoners out of their cells on a daily basis just to rough them up for deterrence. And they beat them, I have to admit, incredibly brutally.
So they used tasers, batons, things like that?
Yeah, exactly. In Mordovia, just like in many other prisons, the beatings were systematic and severe. But in Ryazsk, it was a bit different. The guards didn't jump you for no reason, but if there was even a minor violation of the regime, the retaliation was so feral that I never encountered anything like it, even in Mordovia. You could say that in Ryazsk, they didn't focus on the quantity of the beatings, but rather on their quality. That's another thing that could be mentioned in a review of the establishment.
Thank you for the quality.
Exactly, yeah. There was one textbook story about that. The Saizo territory was split into two wings, the old two-story building and the new four-story building. In the new wing, the ventilation and sewage systems were engineered vertically, just like in standard Soviet apartment buildings, meaning the bathrooms were aligned perfectly, one right under the other across all four floors. Eventually, we realized that through these engineering shafts, you could crystal clearly hear everything happening in the cell below you, and we started talking to each other. We streamlined the process so well that soon we were passing notes and small items between cells using braided strings, or as they say in criminal slang, smuggling contraband through the lines. We deployed a full-blown internal intelligence network out there, exchanging data on who knew what and who saw what. That's actually how we found out back then that our forces had blown up the Crimean Bridge. That happened back in 2022, if I recall correctly. And here's the catch. The guys from one cell started shouting across to their neighbors through the windows or the vents. A guard overheard it and immediately ratted them out to the special forces. The special forces marched in and they beat those guys so savagely that our entire sector, about 250 people, sat in absolute dead silence for the next 3 days. We were terrified to utter a single syllable because we didn't want to draw any attention to ourselves. What was happening behind those walls was pure terror. I later personally met a man who was inside that exact cell. We ended up locked up together in Mordovia later on, and he recalled that day with pure horror. He's well into his 40s, and he told me flat out, "I have never been beaten that severely in my entire life, combined as I was during that single incident in Ryazsk." We had a similar incident happen to us. They transferred us to cell number 23 on the second floor of the old wing. There were three of us in there, and for some reason, that specific room didn't have a surveillance camera. The guards noticed it very quickly and found a way to exploit it. They started periodically pulling us out of the cell and dragging us into a dead end right by the elevator. Anyone who was locked up on the second floor of that wing knows that spot well. It's a wide blind spot where there isn't a single lens, and the corridor itself is wider, making it highly convenient for the guards to spread out and get a full swing with their boots. They'd line us up against the wall right there and brutally beat us. I remember our very first time by that elevator. At first, we didn't even comprehend what was going on. At 6 o'clock in the evening, right before dinner, the cell door flies open. Two guards and one special forces guy walk in. They ordered, "Step out of the cell." That had happened before for routine administrative reasons, but to be pulled into the corridor purely for a beating, we hadn't encountered that up to that point. They marched us over to the elevator, forced our faces against the wall, and the three of them just started beating the three of us. There were three of us and three of them. Among the guards, there was this one employee named Zhehanya, my namesake. Enormous, obese, and an incredibly malicious man who also happened to have this disgusting, high-pitched, squeaky voice, an absolute piece of trash from start to finish. The second guard we nicknamed Chikatilo. He had a very distinct face and these specific glasses. One of the guys caught a glimpse of him up close in the cell once and said, "Damn, boys, I saw his face. He is a dead ringer for Chikatilo, like a direct descendant of the serial killer." Usually we only told the guards apart by the tread on their combat boots, but we remembered this one's face, and the third one with them was the special forces operator. The paradox was that these two local guards, Zhenya and Chikatilo, even though they tried to beat us, did it completely clumsily compared to their partner, but that special forces guy turned out to be a total sadist. It felt like he had professionally trained in Muay Thai or some other brutal martial art. He was delivering such devastating low kicks that he single-handedly dismantled the three of us. Those two local guards just hovered around, egging him on, but after the strikes from the special forces guy, their attempts were completely irrelevant. We barely managed to crawl back to the cell in a state of profound shock. Our legs swelled up instantly and turned completely black from the hematomas. They had shattered everything that could possibly be shattered. Yet my friend Colesso, who has also returned home through an exchange now, just shook his head back then and said, "Man, come on, boys, this is nothing. 3 days ago, during an official interrogation, they battered me so hard that this corridor is child's play. They almost crushed me like a cockroach in there."
Did they do that because of some specific violation or just purely for entertainment?
No, just for fun.
So these are just people living their lives, and then someone thinks, "Oh, we should go beat them up."
It was purely for entertainment. I mean, these are people who just live their ordinary lives and then suddenly think, "Hey, it'd be great to go kick the crap out of some defenseless prisoners right now." These kinds of abuses became a regular thing when a new rotation shift of special forces arrived in September 2022. They beat us that badly on Friday, September 9th, 2022. You can only imagine how brutal the hit was if I still remember that exact date so clearly. We took a serious beating that day. Of course, later on in Mordovia, the scale of violence was vastly larger, but in Ryazsk, it just caught us completely off guard. In September, this group of special forces arrived who couldn't care less about the restrictions of their own management. They systematically organized these events. They would come to the second floor either in the morning or in the evening, pick three or four cells where they knew there was no video surveillance, and pull people out. Down the hall, there was a specific office where they usually held investigative actions. We called it the quest room. They would drag the prisoners in there and through the walls. We could hear the exact sounds of heavy impacts and groaning. They would work over three or four men from our floor, throw them back into their cells, and then we'd hear their everyday voices out in the corridor. "All right, should we go up to the third floor now?" "Yeah, let's go." And everything would start all over again on the next floor, just like that, completely casually, going to torture people between shifts.
Man, now what about the other conditions, like the food or maybe some basic hygiene products? Was there anything even remotely normal in that Ryazsk hellhole?
Look, let me map out how it was set up. You get thrown onto the floor. Second floor, old block, cell number 19. That was my very first cell in that facility, and it happened to be the first one on the food distribution line. There were about 10 to 12 cells in total down our corridor, and each one held anywhere from 6 to 10 people, averaging about 6 guys per cell. Now, like I said, those morons don't even know basic arithmetic. The inmate kitchen hand who came around to serve the food knew the exact head count for the entire floor. I mean, over 10 months, you'd think a person could memorize that, right? But what did he do? He had a 40-liter military food thermos packed with porridge. At the start of the distribution line, he would start panic hoarding the food because he was terrified he wouldn't have enough left by the end of the hallway. Why the hell are you panicking? It's pure math. You don't need to fear it. You just need to count. Is it really that hard to use a calculator? But they still trembled and hoarded. So while he would barely scrape half a ladle for us at the beginning, he'd be piling the plates high for the very last cells. On top of that, porridge has its own physical properties. All the dense grains and heavy ingredients naturally sink to the bottom of the tank, while the thin water rises to the top based on density. This kitchen hand didn't mix a damn thing. Are you kidding? Nobody cared about that. As a result, he scooped straight from the top, so not only did he only give us half a ladle, but it was also nothing but pale, watery liquid. He did it purely to ensure he wouldn't run out before his shift ended. The only thing they divided completely equally was the bread. So just picture this. We're sitting in cell 19, they pour you half a ladle of this watery slime 3 times a day, and that's how you eat for months on end. I honestly thought I was going to starve to death in there long before the beatings or the interrogation torture could kill me.
All right, let's move on to Mordovia now, because we have a specific time limit. How did you find out you were being transferred?
How did the actual transit process happen? They started clearing out the facility floor by floor every 3 days, starting from the first floor. We could hear all of it through the walls and knew exactly what was happening. It would happen in the morning, completely out of nowhere, but through the internal echo of the prison walls, we could distinctly hear the guards dragging mattresses around. That's when we knew for certain they were preparing a transit. By that time, I had already been moved to the fourth floor, which put me in the very last batch slated for the ATAR. And back then, with pure hearts, we naively believed we were finally heading home for an exchange. By the way, let me make an important side note. Every SIZO has an internal case officer, an operational investigator. We only figured out their hierarchy much later, but back then, we were just starting to understand it. This internal investigator runs operations on absolutely everyone. He doesn't just watch the prisoners, he keeps tabs on the prison staff themselves. He has every single person under his thumb. And in Ryazsk, there was this one operative, surprisingly honest. When I analyzed everything I went through later, I realized he was the single person in my entire captivity who never lied to me once. He didn't spill secrets or talk too much, obviously, but everything he did say turned out to be the absolute truth. When it was time for our etar, they marched us out into the corridor and handed us civilian clothes to change into. I was standing there with a massive smile on my face. He looked at me and asked, "Zhenya, what are you grinning for?" I replied, "Well, citizen commander, I just can't believe I'm finally going home." He looked at me completely calmly and said, "What do you mean home? They're gonna thrash you within an inch of your life out there." And he didn't lie, you know? He was honest to the core. At the time, I naively thought he was just pulling my leg with a twisted joke because he loved that specific brand of dark humor. You know that type of person. He says terrifying things, but smiles while doing it, so you can't tell where the catch is. But there was no catch. Exactly what he said is exactly what went down later. So, there we are, riding in this prison transport truck. All the guys are incredibly joyful. I had three close friends there with me, Andriy, Artur, and another brother in arms. One of them has already made it back, and I'm still waiting for the other to be released. We spent the whole ride frantically planning our futures, picturing how we're about to board a plane, land in Ukraine, hug our families, and then it's just full immersion back into life, good food, drinks, movies, everything. It felt absolutely perfect. Suddenly, the truck grinds to a halt. They start calling us out one by one. The doors open, a guard steps out. And in that exact second, we clearly hear music blasting outside. Someone in the crowd whispers, "Hey boys, can you believe it? We're gonna board the plane accompanied by music." Man, life has never brutally blindsided me the way it did that day, February 7th, 2023. I have never experienced a psychological blow that devastating in my entire life. That was the single most ruthless mind game you could possibly imagine. I'm standing there thinking, "What goddamn music, are you mocking us?" It turned out there was just some radio blasting at full volume nearby, but through the roaring engines, we couldn't make out what kind of songs they were. I was the last one out. The second my boots touched the ground, they forcefully bent me in three folds. They zalomili my hands tightly behind my back and shoved a thick paper folder into my fingers. It turned out to be my own personal case file. I'm marching half blind, my mind racing. Why on earth am I holding my personal file if we're going to Ukraine? Why would they traffic these papers with us? Is it really that important for them to legally show how they treated me? Why am I even holding this folder? And right then, they brutally slam a heavy sack over my head. We are marching under escort step by step, and I can feel that everything around me is going completely wrong. Suddenly, we get closer, and through the fabric of the sack, I hear wild, piercing screams. Just pure, unhuman shrieking. Someone is getting brutally savaged. People are getting interrogated, and men are screaming in agony. And in that exact fraction of a second, the horrific realization hits me. We've landed, but we are nowhere near home.
I encourage you to leave a comment under this video. It helps boost the YouTube algorithm and push this episode into global trends. The extended, uncut interview with exclusive details is already available on Patreon. By unlocking it, you'll dive deeper into Evgen Malik's story while supporting the independent survival of our media project. See you there.